You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Carrie Lutz. It's 7/28/21. Well, the markets, gold person you're about to hear from, called the market high last August. He's been right on the money. He told you what was going to happen last time we spoke about 8 weeks ago, and he's going to tell you now what he sees down the pike. I am talking about the erstwhile Bob Hoy, a good friend of the show and somebody whose opinion you need to always listen to and weigh. And if you got a question for Bob, send me an email, kl@carrielutz.com. Bob, it's great to have you back. How you doing?
Fine. Well, beautiful day here in Vancouver. So, hey, the market's going our way. There's no complaints at all. And I believe it or not, 2 weeks ago, started to write a book on financial market history. So anyways, life is good.
Writing the definitive treatise on financial history, you got a little bit of competition.
I promise you, I won't use the word treatise in the book.
Okay. Well, if I read a book. It was an audio book. It was horrible. Called The History of Debt. And it was just so, it had such a feeble understanding of what debt is really about and how it works.
Oh, dear.
All these things. And it was just an awful book.
Yeah. Well, for me, I've been thinking about it for years. And I couldn't get out of thinking, just write it in chronological order, beginning in ancient Egypt. And I thought, no, that won't work. And then all of a sudden, 2 weeks ago, the whole concept just like that. And I'm very pleased. I've got a preface done that's 1,600 words, so I think I'm writing a book.
All right, this is where the editor comes in. You know, the editor is the guy who you give him the book and you're still writing. And he says, Bob, you're done. Stop right now. Don't write another word. You are done. So you got to get yourself a good editor.
We got to have more than 1,600 words, too. So anyways,
So
the market's out there.
Yeah. Stock market.
Oh, our basic theme, as you know, has been that 2021 could have been the year where a great financial bubble completed. And that was based on the fact that since the early 1700s, you had the South Sea Bubble in 1720, which was a little less than a decade after the previous huge peak in global commodities. And each of the great financial bubbles since, including 1929, which was number five, completed at around a decade after the previous big high in commodities. Now, the last big high in commodities was 2011. Gold and silver, base metals were terrific, the whole thing. And so then you count out and 9 years, 10 years, so this looks, like it's 10 years. So we just in January hit on this being the year probably that it completes. And then within this, we just fell back on the old seasonals that previous great financial manias, going back to the first one, South Sea Bubble in London, it peaked in June. And then as it occurred in London when it was the world's financial center, they typically peaked in May or June. And then we had another one in January. My colleague noticed that when the New York Stock Exchange margin debt reached a certain rate of growth, then the market would likely peak about 6 months later. And that rate of growth had been reached in November. So that counted out to May. And then you can have like a seasonal rally in copper to a secondary one till July, which we've gotten. Lumber can have a seasonal high in June. It was in May. So a number of things then. So to give us some elbow room, we said that all the positive aspects of the great financial speculation would likely complete at around mid-year. So sometime around now. And various hot groups have set technical excesses that are incredible, you know, the cryptos and things like that. And the lumber sector was incredible. So anyways, Kerry, we're very pleased that so far we are getting a huge speculative bubble within the right year. And then within the year, at around mid-year, which we're getting. So now what we want to watch for is the things that tripped up previous great speculations. And one would be the U.S. dollar turning up. And it built its pattern. Often when it gets an oversold like it did in January, that's when we started looking at it, that it will build a base for about 4.5 months. And this time it took 6 months. And the base completes when the DX rises above its 20-week exponential moving average. Well, that was at 91 in March, April. And so that completes the base, which we were pleased with. And then what you want to have is the taking out overhead resistance. And that would be going through 93. And it did that just this week. So that sets the uptrend. So we've got the base in the U.S. dollar complete. It's now set the uptrend. And we've found that when you're into a financial contraction, the senior currency goes up. So this is set now. The other one that goes with this is the gold-silver ratio. And it built a base and again took by rising, took out the 20-week and then now at a new high. So this one is also in the gold-silver ratio. It goes down in a boom and up in a bust. So this thing is now early on an uptrend and is anticipating some problems in the credit markets. Same with credit spreads. We use the JNK divided by TLT, the long bond, and it has broken down. So step by step, Kerry, we're seeing the things that were part of the bubble begin to change at about the right time. So now what we did is use some poetic license and said that the sunshine would probably run to mid-year and then in August turn to twilight. And then after August, when you might have some liquidity problems, it would turn into the twilight zone. And you know what that means. So, hey, I hate to say it, but it's on track. So recently, there's a whole lot of noise that 1970s inflation is going to come back. And our research just doesn't see it. The financial bubble is the huge thing. And the financial bubble also includes bonds. And you've had the German 10-year note get to almost minus 1% nominal. You've never had that in financial history. So that's a sign of a huge bubble. And then you've had short squeezes, the most brutal in history. You got the crypto market, which price gains for a huge market cap have been unbelievable. So our view is that the party really is in financial assets, and history has shown for 300 years that once the party in financial assets is over, it's deflation for most everything. So, and I would say the transition was likely to start around now, and it seems to be starting. So The idea of deflation, most asset prices, is not really popular at the moment. But I'm staying with it because it's an old pattern. Now, this may be concerning to those of us who really like the gold sector, but what you get is you have to look at real prices, like deflated by the consumer price index. And copper is one we've got a long history on, back to 1830 or something like that. But in the final reaches of a great financial mania, copper's real price will go up as deflated by the consumer. And it has over the last year. The other part of that is opposite, where gold's real price, deflated by the CPI, goes down. And it went down from a sensational peak last July, a year ago, to a few months ago, and it's turning up. So in the final stages of a bubble, we've had base metal real prices go up. Check, that's good stuff. As gold went down, check, that's good stuff. So somewhere there'd be a transition in here. But what I want to emphasize is that in a post-bubble deflation, most everything falls relative to the price of gold. As we've mentioned, where you take the deflated price, and as it goes up, it relates to improving profit margins for gold miners. Their costs go down. And it doesn't matter what the price of gold does. Well, it does matter. But the main thing, if their costs are going down as the real price is going up, it improves their profitability. And this is where you then have a multi-year bull market for the gold stocks in a post-bubble contraction. And just to give you an idea on how some of these things can go, is Homestake was the premier producer back in the late 1920s, and the price of gold was fixed at $20.67 an ounce. So during the 1929 boom, their cost went up. The price of gold didn't change, but right. the real price went down. So they actually almost lost money in 1929, and the gold stocks underperformed the S&P. And then you could have bought Homestake for around $9 for maybe the next year and a half in 1930 into 1931. And then it started to hook up. So if you take Homestake stock to the end of 1932, and it wasn't until March 1933 when Roosevelt started fooling around with the price of gold and raised it up to 35. So end of 32, the price of gold was still fixed. But because their costs had plunged, their earnings went up something like 130%. And the stock was up something like 130% as well to the end of 32 when everything was getting trashed. And eventually, Kerry, Homestake went to the mid-60s, like $65 a share. And then in those days, gold miners paid out everything they made by way of dividend. So they were paying $4.50 a share dividend annually on a stock that you bought for $9. Hey,
that's pretty good.
In the Depression, that was very good stuff.
Yeah, that was real good. So we're going to see the real price of gold increase, but the nominal price go down. Is that what's going to happen?
Don't just survive, thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Doré Copper Mining is a premier, near-term, high-grade copper and gold redevelopment opportunity with tremendous exploration potential only 14 kilometers from the town of Chibougamau in mine-friendly Quebec. Doré Copper is debt-free and owns a 2,700-ton-per-day mill with an 8-million-ton tailings facility ready to be used. There is already power to site, and it is accessible by paved highway and rail. Doré Copper aims to produce a profitable hub-and-spoke operation of over 100,000 gold equivalent ounces per year, or over 60 million pounds of copper equivalent by 2024. Because of the existing infrastructure and location, a low capex is anticipated to recommence production. Doré Copper trades under DCMC in Toronto and under DRCMF on the OTC. To learn more, go to dorecopper.com. That's dorecopper.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
Well, here's one of the things that happen. And as I mentioned, in a post-bubble contraction, the senior currency goes up. And one of the mechanisms there is that in a financial storm, the careful money just wants liquidity, a place where you can park it and get it back. Well, U.S. Treasury bills, shorter than 1 year stuff, that's very liquid. And the other liquid item is gold. So they'll go to gold. So you're gonna, it'll put a bid in for the U.S. dollar, but it'll also put a bid in for gold. But to my mind, the dollar price of gold doesn't matter. The real price will be going up. But the problem is, for the real price of gold to really move up, you have to go into the financial crisis. We go into financial crisis, the New York big stock market will get hit hard, and gold shares will go down. But we had the technicals, as it mentioned in July a year ago, that got us out, and we will have the technicals that'll get us back in, say, let's take a guess, in November. So the good stuff will be a contraction for the gold stocks, but initially it'll take them down. So there will be another terrific buying opportunity.
Market, right? It'll take it down with the rest of the market.
The baby with
the bathwater.
Yeah, but what happens, and I think this will become important, is that the gold stocks will outperform the S&P, and on the rally that came out of 2018 for gold stocks, the GDXJ to last summer's high, the gain was 2.2 times the gain for the S&P. So it works. So here's the other thing. So what happens? It's one thing to have the S&P going up and gold stocks going up, but if you've got gold stocks materially outperforming the S&P, guess what? There's a whole lot of portfolio managers that otherwise wouldn't look at the golds will have to buy them. They'll have to get in.
Right.
So that's ahead of us. And so is then what'll make, I think, a multi-year bull market for gold stocks, and not just going up, but outperforming the S&P by a material amount. Hey, it's going to be the place to be.
Hey, it's baked in the cake. You're saying deflation, which means if that's going to happen, we're going to see mass defaults of debt all over the world.
Oh.
And that means that credit is going to be unobtainable. Do I have that right?
Yep, that's right. It's called the liquidity crisis. Here's one. Like, for example, I just wrote down the headline. China's currency bonds tank in tandem amid fears on a foreign sell-off. Now, and there's another headline. China's crackdown rocks investors. Everybody's in the crosshairs. So I didn't read the details on it, but obviously Chinese authorities are doing something to kind of tighten up on speculation. But it's at a time most of the financial disasters have occurred in the fall.
And you know what else? Their flooding season. Last year was almost a mega tragedy. Like, we can't even believe.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
This year is worse. And it started earlier. It's not letting up. Mm-hmm. And it could well culminate with the collapse or the intentional demolition of the Three Gorges Dam, which will basically shut the country.
I wouldn't wish that on anybody.
No, of course not, but it should have never been built.
You're right. You're right in bringing it forward. But the natural disaster would be a post-bubble contraction.
Yeah.
Made worse by other events, that can happen. Well, even in Germany recently, they had the worst floods in 200 years.
Yeah, and then the Western U.S. is burning, and so is Northern Canada, our neighbor to the north.
Don't I know about it?
Yeah, well, I'm sure it's interfering with your blue skies that we love so much, why we come to Canada in the summer. So, supply chain disruptions. Bob, tell us what that is really about. Don't give me the line, it's cause of a certain health problem induced. There's more to this supply chain than anybody's talking about. So let me go to an expert who studied supply chains going back to the pyramids and knows a thing or two about it. So what is really going on here, Bob?
Now, again, let's go back to a decade after a major global commodity boom, you get a great financial bubble. Now, with the great financial bubble, you also have a strong thrust in business activity where you actually can get shortages and stuff like that. So I'm looking at the panic was used to extend bureaucratic control. It was totally insane and not required. So that put a tremendous dip in or hit employment, it hit small businesses, just a dreadful scene. But it didn't basically change the overriding thing that a bubble was likely to complete this year. And with the bubble, there would be a strong upthrust in the economy. And I can give you an example. 1873 was a pretty good bubble. And in Europe, 1871, you had two major powers at war, Prussia and France, and the important city of Paris was under siege, bombardment with cannon, and folks starving to death. But the bubble was scheduled to peak in the summer of 1873, and it did. So from that one, you learn that when a bubble's going to peak, it's going to peak, and very strange and unpredictable things can happen, but it won't change the timing on it. So 1873, a major war in Europe, didn't change the timing on the bubble. And this time, they shut down because of did not change the timing of the bubble. So shortages, sure, there are chips for computers and cars and stuff missing, and you've had a stack up of shipping and stuff like that. But what it is the main thing is the final upthrust of business activity in the final stages of a financial bubble. That works for me, and I think this is the case,
All right, because I was wondering if it was a loss of faith in the senior currency or something else that we haven't been made aware of, a lack of solvency of banks, and maybe letters of credit are not being honored or accepted by certain entities. I wasn't sure what it was, but I think your explanation.
Oh no, there will be that part. That's the Gary. That's the financial side. Where this is one thing where the Austrian economist, the Mises guys, got it right. Is that Mises himself said years ago, decades ago, that at the top of a boom, bankers did not need to call loans to force the contraction. All they have to do is get a little nervous and stop making them.
Yeah, and they haven't been making them here in 10 years. You've seen those Fed numbers. We've had zero loan growth.
Yeah, it's what appears to be, well, you got bids for everything. You got bids for junk bonds. You got bids for commodities. You got bids for houses. You got bids for all kinds of weird stocks. And it appears to have, plus the Fed providing all kinds of cash flooding into the market. So it appears to be liquidity. But it isn't, because a huge amount of it is leveraged through New York Stock Exchange margin and leverage here, leverage there. And that leverage has to have rising prices every day.
Yeah.
Prices stop going up, all of a sudden the game's over.
Yes.
And here's the other pattern, is that earlier in the year you had setbacks and the dollar rally into March. And that was when Argentina, South Africa, and Turkey discovered that their central banks were running out of liquidity. And then you've now got, I used to call these lesser exchanges, but with China and India now being so big, you had to change the description from lesser to outlying exchanges, right, markets. And I say, although the Chinese authorities are talking about tightening this and tightening that, it's probably tightening naturally anyways. And of course, the central bankers all want to look like they're on top of things. So this is now written in stone. We have all of the speculation that you might ever wish to see in a bubble, and we're in at the right time, and we're now in the transition. I see it as right on path to a massive liquidity problem being discovered after mid-September, let's say. That's just a guess, you know.
Uh-huh.
And all of the great bubbles, all five of them in history, crashed in the fall. And the 1825 bubble in Europe and in London was a huge one, and it crashed in the fall, but that crash continued right into January, whereas all the other crashes sort of were really hit hard in October and then tested the lows in November, and then that was over. But as I said, the one in 1825, that thing was still killing them right into January. So, but also on these initial hits to the market, that's just the start, because that's what sets off a multi-year contraction. And one of the wisest comments I ever saw from the Economist magazine was, with the first part of the 1873 crash, probably October that year, and the Economist said, oh yeah, it would be after the first crash, said the crash may be over. No, said the panic may be over, but the results of the panic are not over. And when I read that one, I made a note on that one, because that is a very astute observation. The panic may be over, but the results of the panic are not over. And that depression lasted till 1895. Mm. And in England, the senior economy then, it was weak until 1884. When then senior economists in England started calling it the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always referred to as the Great Depression. And it ended in 1895. But you had senior economists like Rostow in England, as late as 1939, they were still publishing papers on how the 1873 and 1895 depression could have been prevented. And then they said, oh, we've got another one.
Oh, God. Isn't it funny the way history repeats itself?
I tell you that there is no finer source of irony than to read theoretical economists and compare what they're saying to what's been happening in the markets. It's a never-ending gift, the irony between what the establishment says about financial markets and what happens in financial markets. It's actually, not to be too sarcastic about it, but it's a delight for me to find these ironies in history and then watch for them. There's going to be ironies all over the place. Like one of them was in December 2007, the top of that great boom was the middle of October. December, the prominent economist at Harvard, Greg Mankiw, he said that nothing can go wrong because, and I quote, they had a dream team of economists at the Fed.
Yes.
And December 2007 is when the recession started, according to the NBER. So that was a perfect one. But you got to go back to the late stages of the 1929 bubble, when John Moody, in a Atlantic Monthly article, said that nothing could go wrong because the world now had the Federal Reserve, and it was new and it was scientific. Nothing could go wrong.
Oh, that's great.
Carrie, there's even one more if you can handle it.
One more.
The top of the 1873 bubble, the New York Herald, an important magazine, newspaper then, editorialized that in the financial markets, nothing could go wrong because the United States did not have a central bank. It had the treasury system, and the treasury could provide any amounts of liquidity.
Yeah.
And then in England, at the same time, the highly esteemed editor of The Economist, Walter Bagehot, he'd publish his book, what was it called? Anyways, I'll think of it. And in the book, he said that a recession, a contraction, was a form of neuralgia that could be prevented by the Bank of England providing near-term liquidity. The book was called Lombard Street, and published in 1873 at the top of a bubble. And he explained how a central bank, even on gold at that time, could prevent a contraction. And as I said, it was called the Great Depression and lasted until 1895.
Wow. That's amazing.
Anyways, I'm sure there'll be more of these ironies.
Yeah. Ironies, the financial world and history is rich in ironies. And you think you've seen it. You think you've seen something, and then something else happens and you realize you didn't know anything. It's very humbling.
Yeah.
And history, to me, we should be studying it, not just to learn from it, but to temper your humility, your pride, I should say, to temper your pride and your hubris.
Yeah.
Because it's all been done before, and this time is no different than all the others, as much as you'd like to believe it. Bob, it's always great having you. Just go ahead and Google Bob Hoye, H-O-Y-E. You'll find all of a lot of his writings and everything else, and you can connect with him on the web. Or better yet, send us an email to kl@carrylutz.com, and we will connect you with Bob. Bob, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Very good, Carrie. You have a good time now.
Thanks for listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.